Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Recently, I read a short personal essay written by a doctor for the New England Journal of Medicine. In it, she described her awakening to her own personal bias based on race. She asked herself and looked through records to see if she could find any racist behaviors in her treatments of patients. She found at least two behaviors. She sits further away from people who do not share her white skin color and spends less time with them. This seemed to me like pretty straightforward honesty on her part, but I was intrigued by the massive number of responses to her essay, most of which lauded her for her efforts and for giving them ideas where to look in their own behaviors at work. But many were not complimentary and suggested that she stick to doing medicine without adopting liberal values, and some of them were a lot less complimentary than that. I'll just leave it at that. So I was interested to find an article titled Getting Sick While Black, which outlines how, no matter their background, education, or income, Black women are chronically failed by the American healthcare system. This is written by Erica Stallings for Oprah Magazine and was published in October 2018. Imagine this. You go to the doctor and routinely feel unseen, unheard, misunderstood. Sometimes you fear you've been misdiagnosed, but your concerns are brushed off. You aren't apprised of the full range of treatment options. The doctor seems to assume they don't apply to you or that you can't take in all the information. Your local hospital is underfunded, the equipment outdated, frequently non-functional. You're denied pain meds. You're handled brusquely. Staff openly question your ability to pay. While not every Black woman has had experiences like these, they're disappointingly familiar to legions of us. Indeed, there is enough anecdotal and factual evidence to suggest that a dangerous color-based bias is baked into the American healthcare system, affecting even well-educated upper-middle-class patients, the type you might expect to be immune from such iniquity. Several years ago, I was one of those patients. In June 2014, at age 29, I underwent genetic counseling and testing and learned I had a BRCA2 gene mutation, an inherited condition that elevates the risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer. It turns out I was fortunate even to have access to this screening. A 2016 Journal of Clinical Oncology study found that Black women, regardless of their risk level, are less likely than white women to undergo genetic testing, in large part because physicians are less likely to recommend it to them. When I opted for a preventive mastectomy later that year, Black women who test BRCA positive are also less likely to undergo risk reduction surgeries like this, I had a number of advantages. At the time, I was a litigation attorney at a mid-sized law firm, and my employer offered excellent health insurance that covered the full cost of my pre-op appointments and surgery. My main advantage, though, was a strong social network. My college roommate happened to be married to a cancer researcher who'd given me a list of questions to bring to appointments. A friend who sits on the board of a nonprofit had referred me to a fellow board member who fortuitously headed the cancer screening and prevention program at one of New York City's top hospitals. Amazingly, I'd gotten an appointment with this doctor within 1 week of emailing her to ask about genetic testing. Once I received my diagnosis, she helped me identify and schedule appointments with a respected breast surgeon and plastic surgeon. This kind of access, I would come to learn, is a rarity among Black women. Many of the white patients I meet in BRCA support groups got referrals through family, friends, or business or social connections. At one support group meeting, the white daughter of a hedge fund manager recounted interviewing several leading oncologists from across the country before making her choice. In contrast, when I volunteered at BRCA education events for Black women, they talk about struggling to find a genetic counselor of any rank. So I was lucky, until the morning I was discharged from the hospital. When I woke up after surgery, I was groggy from the anesthesia and slightly disoriented from the weight of my new breast implants. The walk from my bed to the bathroom felt like a marathon. I asked my mother to call a friend who could accompany us home in case we needed help getting up the stairs to my second floor apartment. A nurse, a white woman probably in her 40s, overheard and said, "You didn't have surgery on your legs. I don't understand why you would need assistance." More pressing was the matter of my surgical drains, installed post-mastectomy on both sides of my chest to collect blood and lymphatic fluids. The left drain wasn't functioning properly, so I asked the same nurse if she could call one of the surgeons who'd performed the operation. I was nervous because my mother had suffered through an infected drain during her own mastectomy 7 years prior. It had even been written in my chart during early morning rounds that my left breast was slightly red. I didn't want to go home until I knew it was okay. But the nurse refused to contact the surgeon. She said the hospital would be penalized if I wasn't discharged within 24 hours of my admission and that I'd have to deal with the drain as it was. Again, I requested that someone call my surgeon. Instead, a second nurse, also a white woman, was brought in to explain that there was no time. I needed to be out of the room, which seems strange for a highly regarded facility known for its patient-centered care. After an extended back and forth involving the two nurses, a hospital administrator, my mother, and two friends I'd summoned for support, one of the nurses finally agreed to call my plastic surgeon. When she came to inspect the drain, she saw that the incision wasn't large enough to create a proper flow. After a 5-minute fix, I was on my way with two functioning drains. Although I can't prove that the treatment I received was racially motivated, I can say that the experience is consistent with what I hear from other Black women. And it is markedly different from what I see on Facebook support groups for those dealing with BRCA mutations, an overwhelmingly white cohort. For instance, I've met so many amazing nurses. I plan to track down the nurse who was there for me the first day after my mastectomy. I want to send her flowers. I have never come across a white woman posting a story anything like mine. In the past year, we've learned how dangerous it can be to give birth in this country if you're Black, how we are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes than white women, how Black babies are twice as likely to die as white babies. In fact, from cradle to grave, a Black woman in the U.S. can expect to have worse health outcomes than a white woman. She is 40% more likely to die from breast cancer, even though she's less likely to have breast cancer in the first place. She's more likely to die from cancer in general. She's less likely to receive a prescription for painkillers from an ER physician, even when experiencing the same level of pain and symptoms as a white patient. She's more likely to die at a younger age of heart disease. To make matters more dire and far more complicated, the disparities don't exist only in health outcomes, in how things turn out, for good or ill, once you seek medical treatment. Black women have worse health, period. We're more likely to live with diabetes, obesity, and high blood pressure. We're more likely to live with major depression. We have double the risk for stroke, and along with Black men, are twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's. Do genetics, income, and education level play a role in these stark differences? Of course. Does it matter that Black women are less likely than white women to have health insurance? Without a doubt. But consider that even these factors are highly influenced and compounded by, and in some cases due to, racial injustices. And consider that Black women fare worse not just when it comes to a few particular diseases or disorders, but across a wide spectrum. Then consider that the mortality rate for babies born to Black women with a doctorate or professional degree is higher than the rate for babies born to white women who never finished high school. A picture begins to emerge of forces at once bigger, deeper, and more insidious at play. To be clear, getting the best results out of the American healthcare system can be difficult for anyone. Between Byzantine insurance rules, the profits over people MO of corporatized care, and variations in resources and access depending on where you live, all patients must be proactive, informed, assertive, at times aggressive. If you're a Black woman, you just better be more so, and even that might not be enough. Let's back up to before a woman goes to the hospital, before she even gets sick. Let's go back 60, 80, 100 years to the days of Jim Crow. The laws that codified racial segregation and discrimination took a measurable toll on Black people's health. Nancy Krieger, Ph.D., a professor of social epidemiology at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, has found an association between Jim Crow laws and premature mortality rates for African Americans born under those laws. Krieger cites a variety of potential reasons for the link, including lack of access to adequate medical care, excess exposure to environmental hazards, economic deprivation, and the psychological toll of dealing with racism as a part of daily life. Though Jim Crow laws were abolished in the mid-1960s, their effects endure. Krieger says, "My research shows they're still being reckoned with in the bodies of people who lived through that time." She's not speaking metaphorically. On the contrary, Americans' version of apartheid appears to have left its mark on a cellular level. Black women born before 1965 in Jim Crow states are to this day more likely than those born at the same time in other states to have estrogen receptor negative breast tumors, which are more aggressive and less responsive to traditional chemotherapy. Krieger's findings align with the theory of weathering, proposed in 1992 by Arlene Geronimus, now a research professor at the University of Michigan's Population Studies Center. The idea is that over time, the toxic stress of dealing with discrimination, stress that has been found to result in increased cortisol levels and inflammation, leads to poorer health outcomes, as well as premature aging, since it can literally shorten our telomeres, the protective caps at the end of each of our chromosomes. In a study published in 2010 by Geronimus and others, Black women between the ages of 49 and 55 were an estimated 7.5 years older biologically than their white counterparts. In other words, just as a house continually battered by storms will eventually list, sag, and crumble, the health of Black people in America is corroded by the relentless assaults of racism. Location, location, location. That's the mantra of David R. Williams, Ph.D., a Harvard professor of public health, sociology, and African American studies, whose research focuses on social determinants of health. Williams is convinced that de facto segregation, today some 48% of African Americans live in neighborhoods that are primarily Black, is a key driver of health inequities. In the United States, your zip code is a stronger predictor of your health than your genetic code, Williams says. Why? For starters, communities of color are more likely to be located in areas with higher levels of air pollution, which means the people who live in those communities are regularly breathing in higher levels of particulate matter, dangerous particles that can lead to respiratory issues, lung cancer, and heart disease. In addition, research shows that Black neighborhoods, defined as including 60% or more Black residents, have the fewest supermarkets and therefore less access to fresh produce and lean proteins. Black neighborhoods are also more likely to lack a local primary care physician. The odds of a shortage of such doctors are 67% higher and may have a dearth of medical specialists. A 2009 study showed that more African Americans living in a county correlated with fewer colorectal surgeons, gastroenterologists, and radiation oncologists. Researchers have also identified a connection between racial segregation and the quality of care a patient receives. A black person who lives in a segregated community and undergoes surgery is more likely to do so at a hospital with higher mortality rates. Facilities in such communities are often lacking in resources compared with those in primarily white areas. LaToya Williams, 41, lives in a Brooklyn neighborhood where roughly 60% of residents are African American. "I like living here," she says. "I own my home, and the neighborhood has a suburban feel that's hard to find in the city." Williams, now a senior manager for primary care systems at the American Cancer Society, found a pea-sized lump in her breast in January 2007. The local surgeon she visited ordered a sonogram, but then, Williams says, dismissed the lump as fatty tissue. 7 months later, it was the size of a walnut. Alarmed, Williams pushed for a lumpectomy, which led to a diagnosis of stage 3 invasive ductal carcinoma. Williams was to start chemotherapy immediately, which meant she needed a port implanted below her collarbone to receive medications and IV fluids and have blood drawn for tests. The procedure was done at a Brooklyn hospital by her surgeon. Williams recalls waking up afterward and telling her doctor she couldn't breathe. "He said that was a normal reaction after surgery," she recalls. 30 minutes later, she was still gasping for air. Her mother was able to flag down a different doctor, who immediately inserted an emergency chest tube to help Williams draw breath. An X-ray revealed that her lung had been punctured during the port installation. This meant 2 weeks in the hospital for what is normally an outpatient procedure, as well as a frightening delay in starting chemo. When Williams finally did begin treatment, it was revealed that the port had been installed incorrectly and a new one had to be put in her arm. Williams' treatment plan also included radiation. The hospital where she was getting chemo didn't accept her insurance for the treatment, so she turned to another one nearby, one that was recently given a D rating by the Leapfrog Group, a nonprofit that analyzes hospital performance. There was no direct subway line between her office and the hospital, so Monday through Friday, Williams had to make the 35 to 40-minute drive after work. However, on several occasions, she arrived at the hospital only to learn that the radiation machine was broken and she wouldn't be able to get treatment that day. As a result, Williams says, her radiation regimen, which was supposed to be completed in 8 weeks, took closer to 10. "That's the last thing you need when you're already scared for your life," she says. In 2010, Williams shared her story at an alumni meeting of her college sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, America's first black Greek letter organization for women. Afterward, another member, Kathy Ann Joseph, MD, a breast surgeon affiliated with NYU Langen Health, introduced herself and told Williams about her work. Joseph also co-heads the Beatrice W. Welter's Health Outreach and Navigation Program at NYU Langen's Perlmutter Cancer Center, which provides access to breast cancer screening, treatment, and support for women in medically underserved communities. Over time, the two women became friendly, and Williams warmed to the idea of meeting with a colleague of Joseph's to talk about breast reconstruction, which she underwent in 2012. On her first visit to NYU Langen's Midtown Manhattan Hospital, the contrast was dramatic. A lobby with the lush plants and sparkling glass vibe of a posh corporate office, cafes with healthy food choices, helpful security guards who didn't treat you like a criminal for simply asking questions, nurses who tended to Williams courteously and promptly, and much nicer gowns. She resolved that the next time she sought medical treatment, it wouldn't be in Brooklyn. "I'll probably never go to a hospital near me again," she says, which is a shame. Everyone deserves to have good medical care in their own community. The personal touch matters, but because research, new life-saving therapies, and affordable coverage grab headlines, the care in healthcare is often discounted. People discussing health disparities typically focus on access to insurance, but even in Massachusetts, a state that has universal coverage, African Americans still have poorer health outcomes, which shows that access to insurance isn't enough, says Karen Winkfield, MD, PhD, a radiation oncologist and associate director for cancer health equity at Wake Forest Baptist Health in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The question is whether people feel welcome and listened to. If a Black patient who may already have some skepticism about the medical system encounters a rude receptionist or a dismissive nurse, Winkfield explains, she is less likely to want to engage. Yet behavior needn't be overtly hostile to be harmful. In a 2016 study, researchers videotaped interactions between non-Black oncologists and their Black patients at cancer hospitals in Detroit, then asked each doctor to complete the implicit association test, the most widely used measure of implicit bias. The findings? Oncologists whose tests showed greater bias had shorter interactions with their Black patients, and their patients rated the interactions as less supportive and had less confidence in the recommended treatments. Even more troubling is when physicians make judgment calls rooted in racial stereotypes. When researchers at the University of Virginia investigated why so many Black Americans are undertreated for pain, they found that a significant number of medical students and residents held wildly erroneous beliefs about biological differences between Black and white people, e.g., that Black people's nerve endings are less sensitive, or that their skin is literally thicker. With any doctor, there's already an imbalance of power, because you're vulnerable and you have to trust this person, says Holly Spurlock-Martin, a developmental psychologist in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. But if you're Black and your doctor isn't, there's an extra layer of concern. So when you find a good Black doctor, you think, I found gold. That's just how precious and rare it can be. Only 5.7% of all physicians practicing in the U.S. are African American, out of a population that is over 13% Black. I definitely trust white male doctors less, and to be honest, I trust white female doctors less as well, unless they come recommended by a person of color, says Lisa, 35, a vice president and senior counsel at a major financial services firm. Many Black women are experts in broadcasting the signs and signifiers of education and success in the interest of receiving better medical care. From an early age, my mother always made me dress up to go to the doctor, says Chelsea White, 29, who works as a senior technical associate at a social science research firm and holds a master's degree in health policy and administration. I'm almost 30 years old, and I still wear business casual to doctor appointments. I also go out of my way to mention something about my education and professional achievements. I've found that when I'm seen as being accomplished, I get more time, attention, and detailed information. Black women were dying from childbirth. That was the story in the news in early 2017 when Whitney, a PhD candidate at an elite university, was newly pregnant with her first child. But she reassured herself that Massachusetts, where she lived, had one of the lowest maternal mortality rates in the U.S. In her last trimester, however, Whitney grew worried when she experienced severe acid reflux and an elevated heart rate. The staff at her group medical practice waved away her concerns and told her to focus on managing her high blood pressure. But when she eventually went into labor, her heart rate shot up still higher and didn't return to normal even after she gave birth. As Whitney lay in the recovery room, she had trouble breathing. The medical staff, believing she might have a blood clot, ordered two CT scans. Both came back negative, so though she remained short of breath, Whitney was discharged. The following day, she went to her primary care physician and requested a full cardiac workup. She also asked whether she might have peripartum cardiomyopathy, PPCM, a form of heart failure associated with pregnancy. being of African American descent is a known risk factor. Upon seeing the results of the EKG and blood work, the doctor said her heart wasn't the problem. A nurse practitioner said it seemed like anxiety and suggested that Whitney take Zoloft. But the next evening, Whitney's blood pressure spiked to 170 over 102. At the ER, tests revealed an enlarged heart. Again, she asked, could it be PPCM? No, said the cardiologist who diagnosed postpartum preeclampsia, a very serious condition to be sure, but not one that rules out PPCM. In fact, the conditions often overlapped, and prescribed beta blockers. At her six-week post-delivery checkup, the nurse practitioner repeated that her persistent symptoms and chest pain could be due to anxiety. Around the same time, Whitney's cardiologist reduced her beta blocker dosage by half. Whitney felt intense pain almost immediately. An echogram showed that her heart, though no longer enlarged, still wasn't pumping properly. She asked her doctor whether the pain could be related to the change in medication. He told me, I don't understand why you're still asking questions, she says. You should be happy your heart is back to normal size. The reality is you're a female black, so probably just have hypertension. Whitney panicked. I was starting to think I might not be around to raise my daughters, she says. Finally, she discovered a PPCM Facebook group through which she connected with James Fett, MD, who referred her to a nearby colleague. Whitney contacted the doctor using her university email. He responded right away. Roughly 12 weeks after her initial inquiry, tests confirmed that yes, she had PPCM. Whitney's attentive new cardiologist effectively treated her condition, and when the dust settled, she began seeing a therapist to help her process the experience. The way doctors and nurses brushed off my concerns made me feel so degraded, she says. My husband and I would like to have more children, but I don't know if I would risk my body again like that. I really don't feel like healthcare institutions are set up to protect women of color. You were brave, people say when I tell the story of my surgery discharge and what I had to do to stand up for myself. But I didn't feel brave in the moment, and I still don't. I was simply trying to survive. That's the reality of being a black woman dealing with this country's healthcare system. That's the end of our article today. Thank you for tuning into Soundbody. Please stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.